Good morning and welcome to Cosmic Influence. My name is Walter Cruttenden and I'm here with co-host Jeff Pitino.
How are you?
And once again, we're exploring this idea that history moves in a great cycle of time with alternating dark and golden ages. And we'd like to look at this idea from all perspectives. And today we're going to be examining some of the ancient ideas concerning death and dying. And to do that properly, we'll look at some more modern experiences through the work of Anna Maria Hemingway in her book, Practicing Conscious Living and Dying, Stories of the Eternal Continuum of Consciousness. And when I first picked this book up, I thought, oh, this is just another book about NDE. And then I quickly realized that while Anna Maria does write about some near-death experiences, and they're interesting in themselves, she's really painting a much larger picture to show us how being in touch with the experience of death can really replenish our view of life and make life so much bigger and so much greater. And there's a number of stories in the book that articulate that. But first, I'd like to make sure our guest, Anna Maria, is on the line. Anna Maria, are you there?
I am. Hello.
Terrific. Great having you on the show.
Great being here.
Jeff will just read a little bit about your background, then we'll get into why you wrote this book.
Well, sure. Anna Maria Hemingway is a PhD candidate and is currently writing her dissertation on The Near-Death Experience, A Mythic Model for Conscious Living and Dying. She also writes articles for various magazines, and her work is primarily focused on all aspects of conscious living and dying. She is also a member of the International Association for Near-Death Studies.
And once again, Anna Maria, the book really moved me in that the way that some of these people were touched by either a near-death experience or having someone around them or close to them die, and seeing how it just reordered and changed their lives in so many ways showed to me the importance of being in touch with that experience versus, you know, sort of shutting it off, which is often the tendency. And I'm curious, what got you into this? Why did you write this book in the first place?
Well, the reason I wrote the book was I went through the dying process with my mother, and it was a very profound experience for me. And like most people, until we're actually faced with dealing with death and grief, I think we tend to blanket out of our lives. And certainly in modern-day cultures, Western modern-day cultures specifically, I think death is often viewed as the ultimate failure rather than part of the cycle of life. So, you know, we don't have very much to help us deal with this whole aspect of death. And when I came through this experience, that part of realization actually had a very profound and almost compelling effect on me. And I found myself really, you know, wanting to explore this whole area a lot more thoroughly. And I was curious about how other people might have had experiences similar to mine. And really, that's how the book actually, you know, was birthed. I think my mother's death was actually the birth of something in me. And, you know, this is what I did with it. And the reason I did it was because I thought, you know, we have very little source material on how to cope with these matters when they come up. And wouldn't it be a good idea to perhaps become a little more curious and actually expand knowledge around the whole death and dying process? And, you know, that is why I wrote the book, and that's what I hope people actually come out of the experience of reading it with, you know, perhaps a different view, a more expanded view, and something that helps them integrate what death actually really means in our lives.
Sure. Well, there's some great experiences in there, and we'll get into a couple in particular, but it's also a beautifully written book. And we need to take a short break, but we'll be right back. You're listening to Cosmic Influence. Welcome back to Cosmic Influence. Anna Maria, I'd like to get into a few of the stories in particular. And first of all, note that you started many of them with a quote from Plato or Socrates. And can you tell us why you did that?
I can. I'm a student of mythology and depth psychology. And Plato often came up in the course of my studies, and I actually became very fond of him. And it so happened that, you know, Plato wrote a lot about trying to understand death and what it meant and how we could do that in his own works. And certainly in The Republic, he used a near-death experience, perhaps one of the earliest actually recorded, to illustrate how coming to terms with death actually helped a person live life in a better way. And so I decided to use Plato in some way, and it just so happened, one of those synchronistic things, that for every single story I wrote, there just happened to be a perfect Plato quote. So, you know, I kind of feel that maybe he was with me, as it were.
Maybe it's so. And here's one by Socrates, who says, "I ought to be grieved at death if I were not persuaded that I am going to other gods who are wise and good." And I think that is the way it is with many of us. If we don't have any knowledge of what's on the other side, then it is, I suppose, a very fearful thing. Whereas you point out clearly that with a little knowledge, it can change lives. So can you tell us one or two of the stories that particularly moved you?
Well, I loved all the stories, actually, because I got to meet all these individuals and, you know, do interviews with them and then actually make, you know, the transcription of these tapes into stories. But I think perhaps when I was speaking to you earlier, you said that you really liked Joanne's story, and that is one of my favorite stories. You know, Joanne was a woman who had a stillbirth daughter. And for many people, that really, you know, isn't counted. When we have a child that dies and it doesn't live outside of the womb, you know, people tend to actually think, well, it never existed, so, you know, you just go on with your life. For Joanne, that didn't happen. It was a very profound experience in her life, and her grief, the grief that we all go through when we actually lose somebody close to us, was immense. But I think Joanne illustrates, again, that even through grief that most people fear and dread, because it's such a, you know, terrifying ordeal to go through grief and let it wash its way through you, I think Joanne's story actually symbolizes and illustrates that allowing that to happen almost is like shedding a skin and coming out of the experience, you know, very often transformed and with a very different idea about life. And certainly Joanne had a long journey after her daughter's death.
Let me just interject, if I might, Anna Marie, that she had carried this daughter of hers to full term, and it was only 20, 30 minutes before she was ready to give birth that no heartbeat was detected.
That's right, yes. Joanne's story really culminates in the fact that she realized that, you know, part of the way of getting through grief was actually to do something for other people, and she started taking small steps in that direction. And, you know, this journey took her to meet Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who she became very close with. And Joanne actually is carrying on the work that Elizabeth started. She founded the Miss Foundation, which is a huge international association that filled that real space and hunger people had for where could they turn to when a child died. And that's what her organization does. It's not just for stillbirth, but it's for anyone that's lost a child, which I think perhaps is, you know, the most devastating loss that we can have when our own children, you know, die before we do.
Right. So, and then she started doing all sorts of things in her child's name. I remember, I guess, the first instance was you know, she has three other children, of course, and but she would have spent so much on a Christmas present for her one child, Cheyenne, that didn't make it. And she gives that, uses that money to buy gifts for orphans and children she doesn't know. And she goes on this journey where she's doing all this good all around the world, really, mm-hmm. because she was so moved by the dying experience.
Well, she says, you know, Cheyenne's death blew her apart, and when the pieces fell back together, she emerged as a totally different person, and that Cheyenne's death for her was an awakening from what she calls a real form of spiritual dormancy in which she wouldn't have noticed before, things like children that didn't have shoes or old people struggling. But what happened to her was so transforming that she became awakened to these things, and so her life completely changed. She found a mission that was of great value to people and, you know, used that experience to grow herself and reach her own highest potential.
Right. She even got the law changed in the state of Arizona. Before this, when someone had a stillbirth child, they would get a death certificate but not a birth certificate. And because of her understanding the griefs that so many other parents in that position went through, they will now issue a certificate that recognizes both the birth and the death.
Yes, and she's still going strong. And, you know, that alone, you know, changing the law was a huge thing to do. But actually, you know, I think these stories actually also really reinforce the fact that when we're really committed to something and we really do our utmost and our best to achieving something, you know, extraordinary things can and do happen.
That's for sure. And, you know, in addition to the beautiful stories you've put in the book, I really love the chapter on birth, death, and rebirth, a continuum of consciousness from an ancient perspective. And this sort of brings it home to us here at this show, is you clearly talk about how in ancient cultures, Greece, Egypt, etc., there was a much greater awareness of death and really life as a continuum through lifetimes and death times, if you will. And by having that perspective, they were able to better deal with this versus in the modern world where we take such a clinical view of life and death that, you know, we almost don't exist if we don't have a body. That's foreign to the ancients, and I think foreign to our soul, because it just seems to cause a lot of psychological problems out there. Can you talk a little bit about some of the ancient beliefs about death and dying?
Well, I think if we look back through all of the sacred texts, and there are many of those, the Egyptian Book of the Dead, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, that's, you know, very popular with people nowadays, we come to see that death is always regarded as a transition. In fact, in most of the world religions, you know, there is some form of life after death. And I think then for people, they had this kind of understanding more in their conscious minds. You know, they were very much more closely attached to the rhythms of the natural world, for example, where we have constant reminders of this cycle of birth, death, and rebirth. And, you know, nowadays we even have major festivals like Easter, which, again, is, you know, resurrection. But we've lost touch with that part. You know, now it's sort of more of a long weekend and DIY in the house and garden centers and things like that. And, you know, for some reason...
Easter eggs.
Yes, for some reason, the actual real meaning of all these rituals, customs, festivals, and the ancient way of looking at things, certainly death, has receded into the back of our mind, and you know, now we seek to prolong life at all costs.
The way you put it in perspective here, too, let me just read a quick paragraph. It says, "The natural world provided and instilled a feeling of oneness with an expanded form of consciousness because nature constantly has the ability to renew itself, and with every death there follows resurrection. This constant cycle of regeneration symbolized the eternal life of the soul, and there were many examples. Each evening, the dying sun, often at its most luminous point, descended and set like a golden globe on the horizon. This is the place where the sky meets the earth, and a fine white line symbolizes the sheerest of veils that separates the visible from the invisible worlds. Every morning, the sun was reawakened, born again at dawn. The moon was also constantly reborn and renewed itself each month. The shore of the ocean was hidden and then exposed by the turn of the unceasing incoming and outgoing tides, and the barren starkness of winter gave way to the reemergence of spring and new life." And then you go on and give some, you know, specifics about some of the ancient beliefs themselves. It's a very well-written book.
Oh, thank you. Well, I think, you know, that this this unfortunate, you know, separation from nature that we find ourselves as human beings facing, you know, in the world in which we live, actually is so detrimental to our soul's yearning to be able to actually flow with those rhythms ourselves.
Yes, and this was an ancient method, or an ancient concept key to life. As we study a lot of the old megalithic structures, say tombs, cairns, dolmens, everything built before roughly the year 1500 BC seems to be aligned with the cardinal points or the equinoxes or the solstices. Mm-hmm. And then as some of these great ancient cultures descend into the Dark Ages, you know, things get very chaotic. And, of course, in the modern world, we've just sort of become very detached from nature. And there is something we're missing there, for sure. And you've helped to, you know, point out that when we get detached from nature, then we lose perspective of some of the big concepts like death and dying.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as they're pushed back into the unconscious collective, you know, it does, as you said earlier, causes all sorts of problems because we have a fear that builds up. You know, fear becomes the bridge between life and death rather than acceptance and understanding. And this fear actually stops us living life as fully as we could if we didn't have the fear. So it's very important to actually get back to some of these ancient teachings, the natural world. And by doing that, we're actually reacquainting ourselves, I think, with a memory that we already contain within, you know, that we do know all these things, but they're actually just totally, you know, repressed.
Totally repressed. Well, on that note, hold that thought. You're listening to Cosmic Influence with our guest today, Anna Maria Hemingway. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Cosmic Influence. Anna Maria, when you were researching your book, when you first decided to write it, how did you go about researching the stories that are in it and meeting the people?
Well, I actually found the book... I think for me, I was inspired to write the book. It didn't just come from me. And once I'd made the decision to do that, it was interesting to see how the stories just started rolling in. You know, I met a person who actually became a good friend of mine who'd had a near-death experience, and his story was very inspirational, and I wanted to use it. And so I started with him. Then I was invited to Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's 75th birthday, or one of her birthday celebrations, and I met Joanne, and Joanne had her story, which included, you know, an involvement with Elizabeth too, And then somebody would tell me, oh, you need to get in touch with Peter Samuelson. You know, he's a person that I think you'd be interested in meeting. And it just went on like that. And the stories, you know, just fell into place. I didn't really seek any of them out at all. Besides, you know, obviously getting in touch with the people and interviewing them and taping their stories.
Well, let me mention one more here. This is Tiffany's story, and you open the chapter. Tiffany Snow had an NDE after being struck by a lightning bolt. During her experience, she was welcome to the world of healers. At the time, she had no idea of what this meant. Following her recovery, she went to attend to her horse, Stars, who was suffering from a chronic skin ailment. Having run out of the prescribed medication, she just rubbed his belly around the outside of the infection and noticed that her hands had become very hot. After repeating a similar treatment, Stars completely recovered. This was the first sign that God had blessed her with the gift of healing. Fascinating story.
Yes, it is, and I think it's very interesting because near-death experiences often do come back, and this merging with the light that they go through seems to not only have some very cleansing, purifying effect, but it also seems to enhance their ability to either have a gift that manifests in healing or telepathy or something else that they didn't previously have. And I think this is, you know, one of the most interesting things about the near-death experience.
Yeah, rarely do you hear about somebody that had a near-death experience and says, oh, it didn't have any effect. You know, it's always, it had some profound effect. They look at life, you know, with a greater sense of appreciation or indeed greater capability.
Yes, they do. And I think that's, you know, the most important fact about the NDE. You know, research is obviously very interesting in scientific and medical terms, but to me, it's, you know, what difference did this experience have in their lives when they come back into their body and start living again? You know, how do they change? And most of them change very much. Lifestyles, habits, relationships all become very different. And I think these stories, you know, reflect the same core elements that we were talking about that come up in all these sacred texts from, you know, thousands of years ago. They're actually a modern-day version, if you like, of the same thing.
Yes, and I noticed, too, that, you know, besides the NDE experience, too, you compared that to a shamanistic type of experience profound life-altering experience that one might have. And you even mentioned the story of Larry Hagman here, and I forgot how you put it. I don't have that chapter in front of me, that he was felt like he was stuck in a golden palace?
Prison, actually. I think one of the reasons that I like Larry's story very much is because, again, it really shows us that, you know, gaining material possessions and fame, wealth, power to a certain extent doesn't sustain, you know, the inner quest to find the true meaning of life. So Larry, although he had all these things, was actually a very troubled person. And through his near-death-like experiences, he actually found the answer that he was looking for, which is the answer that all NDE survivors come back with, which is that, you know, love is the most important thing to share. A life of service in some way is the most gratifying kind of life, not just for other people, but for the self, to be doing things for other people. And he certainly spends an awful lot of his time now, you know, working for very many charitable institutions and making a difference in people's lives.
That's so true. Yeah, if we're just out to get things that we think make us happy, we're really missing out on the real happiness that comes from serving others.
Yes, yeah. Very much so.
I'm just curious, did Larry's type of inner revelation begin at the time that he was symbolically shot in the television series Dallas?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, but it certainly, you know, would be running in a parallel way, wouldn't it? Because obviously that is what happened to him, you know, in a different way, but symbolically, certainly, one of the things that these people do seem to do is, you know, their old selves, they're reborn. They die to their old selves and former values and are reborn. So, you know, that's a very interesting comparison.
And that was a common ancient belief, too, as I recall, where the caterpillar dies but not really metamorphosizes into the butterfly. Mm-hmm. The ancients seem to recognize, you know, that we can go through these very real dying experiences and the soul renews itself, or we can go through seemingly a death-like experience and become something better. I'd like to talk to you a little bit more about some of the ancient cultures and their belief on this topic. We're going to need to take a little break here. I would like to tell our listeners that this will actually be one of the topics at our conference on Procession and Ancient Knowledge coming up on October 4th and 5th down at UCSD, where we have the great ancient Greek scholar Peter Kingsley talking about how Socrates and some of the early Greek philosophers that brought us these modern gifts of logic happened to also experience states of death or dying incubation. Anyway, you're listening to Cosmic Influence. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to Cosmic Influence. Anna Maria, during the break, you had mentioned the importance of being with someone during the dying process. And I wanted to talk a little more about that, because I think that's a very profound thing to say.
Yeah, well, I think the truth of the matter is that sometime during our life, we are going to be confronted with a loved one being in the dying process, and that for many people, this is a very scary and, gloomy place to be. And, of course, we do, when we lose somebody, you know, we will be in that underworld of grief and sorrow, because as human beings, you know, we're going to be missing the presence of somebody that's very precious in our lives. So I'm not for a moment trying to gloss over that fact. But I think that if we try and actively be there with somebody who's actually in the dying process, we come to realize that that person actually is gradually letting go of this life and making a transition into another life. And sometimes when we're fully present and get over that place of just, you know, being terrified at this, what seems to be just a terrible ordeal, we can actually get glimpses of, you know, the other side of death. We can interact with the person more lovingly. We get the chance to be our most authentic selves, and we come to the realization that death does strip away everything that's unimportant, and what we're left with are really the important human values, and that we can actually show compassion and love and go through a healing process. You know, sometimes at the deathbed scene, bitter rifts that have gone on for 40 or 50 years suddenly become, you know, totally unimportant, or they become resolved. So there's a place here for terrific growth. And I think that it's surprising to people sometimes to hear that people will walk away from, you know, a deathbed scene using words like beautiful, peaceful, you know, profound, that there is something else going on. And by actively engaging in that process, we do become privy to that other thing that is going on. And it can be, you know, tremendously healing, as I said, but also death is very profound. It's probably the most profound experience that we can go through with somebody in our lifetime. So I think we need to be a little better prepared for when that time, you know, actually comes to us.
Right. You have a story in the book called John and Mary Ellen's Story. And apparently they weren't prepared or... And so let me just read a paragraph or two, and then you can tell us what happened. When John and Mary Ellen's son, Roscoe, died suddenly from an undetected heart problem, the couple plunged into deep despair and depression. A bereavement counselor suggested they contact a psychic medium. They decided to give this a try and were to find great comfort in communications from Roscoe's spirit, which confirmed that he was still very much alive in the afterlife. And then again, your beautiful writing, the way you open it up. It's a surprisingly cool day in Ojai. John and Mary Ellen have come to escape the famous June gloom from which settles the neighboring coastline, along which settles. But the sun remains hidden by swirling gray clouds. We were sitting in a Mexican restaurant that overlooks the park, where volunteers are busily clearing up the debris from the annual music festival that took place over the weekend. 3 years have passed since Roscoe died. Although they still miss their son a great deal, John and Mary Ellen tell us of their meeting with Sandra Cook at the Church of the Comforter and how it helped to literally save their lives. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I think John and Mary Ellen, again, you know, are examples of what can happen. You know, death can strike at any time and we are unprepared. They found it very difficult to work through their grief, and their actual meeting with the spirit in the spiritualist church with the minister there actually gave them some communication from their son, and they were to find great comfort in this fact, because not only did they actually see their son or an apparition of their son actually in the church at some point, they actually started receiving subtle messages that they knew could only come from him. And this is very much the way that after-death communication works. You know, we have no doubt in our mind that this is certainly the person, because what they're saying or doing is really reflecting their voice or their way in life. And so through these after-death communications, John and Mary Ellen, although they were still, you know, physically missing their son, really had a very strong impression that their son was still alive in some form and that they were able to communicate with him. And it certainly made a great difference to their whole outlook on death following those communications, and help them a lot with their grieving process.
I understand that these communications that sometimes come are almost mentioned trivial pieces of information so as to signal the living that this is real. And I heard about one, and I can't remember. This is one of the televisions I saw, shows I saw, but the parents had... were very much missing their child that had died suddenly, and the communication that came was through one of the mediums on TV that this morning you found my teddy bear that was lodged behind the bed. And of course they're the only ones that knew this information, and so they suddenly knew that this was a real communication. And they just both brightened up, and you could see the grief almost lift in that very instant from their eyes.
Yeah, well, I think it, you know, that reflects, you know, that the simplest of things are really sometimes carry such profound importance. And when you say that, I mean, lots of people say, oh, I'd give anything to see, you know, whoever it was just suddenly appear in front of me. And I think that's probably possible, but the truth is that for most people, they'd be so terrified that, you know, that would override any, you know, wanting to deal with having seen this apparition. So I think that after-death communications are very subtle, because they give us this message. Certainly after my mother died, I remember walking up the stairs of my parents' house the night of her funeral, And I could smell her perfume in one small area of the landing. And it was so strong, and I knew it was her perfume, but it wasn't anywhere else in the house, just in this one tiny area. And I just had this, you know, very overpowering sense that my mother was just, you know, my mother's essence or spirit or whatever it is you like to term it as being, was present. And they're very, very, you know, wonderful experiences to have because they're so reassuring that, you know, something else is happening during this period, as I said before, and that, you know, the deceased person who has left that physical body is still there in some form of consciousness.
Yes, and we need those experiences. But we'll be right back. You're listening to Cosmic Influence.
Welcome back to Cosmic Influence. Anna Maria, I know you have a website. Can you tell us what that is in case any of our listeners are interested in learning more about you and also finding out where they can get your book?
Yes, my website is www.practicingconsciousliving.com, which is also the title of the book. So it's www.practicingconsciousliving.com.
Thank you very much.
And people can get the book at any of the major bookstores or Amazon or on your website?
Yes, the book's available through any good bookstore in the English-speaking world in Europe, and it can actually be purchased through Amazon or, you know, quite a few different internet book sites. And it's also available through my publisher, who are www.o-books.net. So the publisher is O Books.
Okay.
Excellent.
And is this something you do in your day job, so to speak? Do you work with grieving?
I do work with people who are either in this transitional phase themselves or family members who are taking care of or, you know, with somebody who is in the process of making this transition.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. In the previous segment when we were talking about the importance of being with someone and when going through the dying process, that actually really affected me personally as well. I remember when my grandmother passed away a few years ago, that was the first time that, I had really had the chance to really consciously, say goodbye to someone before they passed away. She was dying of cancer, and I'll never forget the last time that I really saw her and interacted with her. I got this intense feeling that she knew it would be the last time that we were going to see each other. And as difficult as that was, when we said goodbye, it was really comforting as well because, and I don't know how to explain that other than to say that I felt like we really did get to say goodbye. And there was a peace to that.
Yes, I think that's, you know, it's such an important part in life for us to be able to deal, you know, with death and dying, and that, you know, what you say does really reflect one of the core elements of the book, that if we can do that, I think death itself does activate a psychic sort of energy that's very similar to an after-death communication or a near-death experience, and that we do get into an altered state of consciousness when we're with somebody. And when you talk about being with your grandmother, I think that very much reflects that, you know, there's something that actually alters us from our everyday state, and we do have that understanding that you did, you know, that there's something very, you know, profound that goes on when we're able to do what you did with your grandmother, and that it stays with us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It stays with us through our lifetime and changes us in some way.
You make a good point there. You know, I think mentally I had always categorized a death in one spot and a meditational or shamanistic experiences in another spot. And, you know, particularly in your book on ancient culture beliefs, you mention how that they're viewed somewhat the same. And if I might, I just read a quick paragraph here. From an early period, the religious traditions of India also included mystical transpersonal practices in order to bring about direct experiential knowledge of an afterlife or continuing state of consciousness. This is shown by the discovery of small sculpted figures in yoga-type postures found on ancient seals from the great Indus Valley civilization in northwestern India. These seals date from the second millennium BCE. Shamanic influences are also present in these seals, and this has led scholars to believe that an early practice of yogic meditation was combined with a type of shamanism in ancient India. And you give some other examples, too. And so it appears that in many ancient cultures, people are sort of practicing dying in a sort of way. Can you comment a little bit on that?
Yeah, I think, you know, I talked about Plato earlier and his advice to his dying, when he was dying, to, you know, his followers asked him for some guidance on the best way to, you know, pursue their quest for, of how to live a better life. And he actually said to them, you know, practice dying. And I think that if we get back into that idea that, you know, this process of birth, death, and rebirth is continual. We experience it in different ways every day ourselves. You know, we have little deaths every day. Every day something's dying. Every day something's reborn within ourselves. And we certainly, if we look out at nature and think that, you know, nothing is moving, then again we're wrong, because every single second something is happening. So we have this continual process taking place. And I think that if we can get into that way of thinking, we get into this flow that we are part of this continuum. And that these ancient shamanic and practices that you talked about, you know, Indian transpersonal experiences, they are all saying the same thing. And I think that's one thing that I really try and illustrate, you know, in the book over and over.
And you do a beautiful, beautiful job of it. And we'd like to talk more on it, but unfortunately we're finished up. You're listening to Cosmic Influence. We'll be right back. Anna Maria, it's been a real pleasure talking with you. Your book, Practicing Conscious Living and Dying, has really moved me. And this topic, I think, is so important. So I encourage all to look into the book, and I thank you for being on the show.
Thanks very much for having me. It's been great speaking with you.
Once again, thank you everyone for listening to the program, and don't forget about the CPAC conference, the Conference on Procession and Ancient Knowledge, coming up in October, and you can get more information on that at www.cpaconline.com.
And in the meantime, bring on the higher ages.